cowpoke went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plow through the ragged sky, and up a cloud he draw.
This is Dan Kimmler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today we will continue to read from Talking Leaves, Contemporary Native American Short Stories. This book was introduced and edited by Craig Leslie, and the associate editor is Catherine Stavrakis. This was published in 1991 by Delta Trade Paperbacks in New York City. We have several stories today, and I'll start by reminding you that our stories are sometimes edited slightly for recording. Now, we will be reading Gerald Weisener's story, The Baron of Petronia. Lester Brown shouted at the birch behind the parish house. He revered the bright woods, but not so white and not so close to the missionaries. He bashed the weeds and threw his words at the white posse on the back porch of the mission. Lester was there at dawn, a mixed blood at the scratch line, to disrupt the land allotment measures on the White Earth Reservation. He prowled behind the birch and sneered at the federal agents on the porch. Later, tired and lonesome, he abided the distance with the mongrels and became a nobleman. That comic moment reared a compassionate tribal trickster, nurtured his wild children and 9 grandchildren, and overturned an instance in racial hocus-pocus on that woodland reservation, which was invented in 1868 by withered white men in cutaway coats. Lester renounced the strict summons to nature in a base and possessive civilization, and he would never wait on a mission porch to have his mind mended by the government, even when his mind needed mending. The trickster seceded at dawn behind the bridal wreath. He pissed on the birch with the mongrels and countered the breach in communal tribal land. In response, he was handed a land patent that banished him to the wild outback on the reservation. Lester Brown, also known as Lester Bow, his callow moniker, son of a pagan mother and a mixed father, a common factor in the fur trade, comes hitherward for his allotment, the last holdover on this reservation roll, the government clerk announced in a taut monotone. Howbeit, the half-breed has lost favor with the mission and our agents. The assistant secretary, braced high in a chair behind a bench, overspread with a martial blanket, scorned the recalcitrant mixed blood when he issued a certificate in his name. The untamed land between the meets and bounds ascribed, the secretary believed, was impenetrable muskeg, as worthless as the peerage he pronounced that humid afternoon in the name of the president. Whereas, there has been deposited in the General Land Office of the United States, an order of the Secretary of the Interior, directing that a fee simple patent issued a Lester Brown, a White Earth Chippewa Indian, for a quarter west of the 5th principal meridian, containing 160 acres in a township named Petronia. Now know ye that the United States of America, in consideration of the promises, has given and granted, and by these presents does give and grant, unto the said Lester Brown, and to his heirs, the lands above described, and the title, Baron of Petronia, to have and to hold the same, together with all the rights, privileges, immunities, and appurtenances of whatsoever nature thereunto belonging, unto the said Baron Lester Brown, and to his heirs and assigns forever. In testimony thereof, I, Theodore Roosevelt, President of the United States of America, have caused these letters to be made patent, and the seal of the General Land Office to be hereunto affixed. The malevolent Assistant Secretary, however, was mistaken about the worth of the land he had allotted to the mixed-blood trickster. The baronage, intended to be a colonial hoax, became a virtue in one generation, and the heritable tribal noblesse has prevailed in various ancestral comedies, here and there, and on the reservation. Petronia is a wild crescent on the White Earth Reservation northeast of Bad Medicine Lake. The shallow creek at the tree line carries the last rumors of glacial rivers that once tumbled the huge granite boulders down the hollows. There, the greens are tender in the spring. A weathered hutment bears down behind the cedar on the west bank of the creek. White pine and a rush of paper birch hold between the boulders on the slow rise of the crescent. Thousands of moccasin orchids bloom in the moist summer shadows. The sunrise widens on the other side of the creek, over emerald waters, blood hues, and wild blues, on a natural meadow. Insects swarm in humid columns, and at night, fireflies leave their traceries in the moist weeds. In a warm pond, on the northern brow of the Wild Crescent, mallards remain in winter. Their green heads and brown bodies cross in the mist between the reeds, between the children on the luscious shore. The Baron of Petronia camped behind the cedars that first summer and built a small cabin near the pond. When the rime turned the leaves and the blues withered on the meadow, he cut white wood for the winter. Later, when the mallards waited on the warm water, he married an orphan who lived in a wigwam over the meadow at Long Lost Lake. Novena May Iron Moccasin was born premature in a wild snowstorm on Advent Sunday. The unmarried mother died from exposure behind the mission. The Benedictine sisters at the White Earth boarding school cared for the child. When she recovered and opened her eyes for the first time on the ninth day of their prayers in 1892, the nuns named her for the novena. She was a dark and silent child, a serious student, and devoted to the sisters at the mission, but she turned down a summons to become a nun. Instead, when she was 15, she created a wild Stations of the Cross on 14 wounded trees behind the mission, and then she retreated to the hardwoods. She was 16 when the second winter loomed on the mound, and a lone trickster wandered close to her wigwam. Crows roused the red pine. Wind rushed the cattails. Beaver cracked the thin ice on the riverside. These motions she understood. But over these natural sounds, late that autumn, she heard several splendid, wild human shouts. The Baron of Petronia came over the meadow and buried his lonesome voice in 7 panic holes. There, he believed, the overturned earth would nurture wild flowers with his words, in his noble name. He planted his voice in this manner, with the seasons, in summer with the moccasin orchids, his solace bloom, on the meadow in spring and autumn, under the cedar in winter. Novena May watched him move between the shadows. She was hushed and courteous at the tree line. He was sudden. His breath was wild, blanched, blued on the tender rise. The mongrels raised their wet noses on the wind, sensed her presence, but the trickster was not aware that she had tracked him more than a mile back across the meadow to his baronage, down to his cedar cabin on the pond. Lusterbow shouted and circled the pond, but she remained silent and held her distance. The mallards browsed on the warm water between them. He recited poesies on the weather, ducks in winter, rhymes on the wild wind over warm water, and the moss down the crescent to the pond, and then he told trickster stories about hibernal bears and the colossus ice woman who consumed lonesome men in winter. "Woman, come over here," he shouted and danced on the shore. The mongrels bounced in the weeds, searched in wild circles for new panic holes, then barked at the Baron. "The Baron of Petronia, he is me, and he welcomes you to live on his land, As long as the grass grows, the river flows. He laughed, waved his hands, and then silence. Would you be the Ice Woman? Novena May remained silent. She smiled and rolled a shoulder when the crows and Whiskey Jacks responded to his loud voice. He then shouted several more humorous invitations. The bewildered mongrels barked at his shadow, made their own panic holes, and then moved to the other side of the pond. Later, when it was dark, he built a fire on the shore and announced that he would wait there for her response. When he leaned back, a solemn shadow in the weeds, she teased the mongrels and returned to her wigwam on the mound. There she touched a blue stone bear that her mother wore when she died in the storm. She listened and remembered the nuns at the mission, the wounded trees, and counted the months that she had been alone. She remembered each month in scent and sound, the harsh cracks on the lake ice, mice in the dried oak leaves, blue mire overturned in winter, black bears on the river boulders, water striders in a warm rain, lightning in the white pine, and her heart beat under moss in cold river water. She would never be ruined with these memories. She would be mocked, but never ruined by a tribal trickster. Novena May untied the birch bark wigwam, packed several bundles on a small travoy, and towed her possessions back across the meadow and down to the warm pond. Lusterbow snored low in the weeds. The cedar embers hissed, snapped, and danced over his head. The mongrels were the overseers that night when she tied the larch poles and recovered her wigwam with bark. She spread woven rushes and cedar boughs inside. The entrance opened on the creek and the best sunrise. She listened to the water resound over the stones, and then made a small fire in the center of the wigwam. The Baron of Petronia awakened with a shiver and stirred the cedar embers. Overhead, mythic hunters spread their scarlet pennons on the dawn. The autumn meadow shimmered, and the paper birch on the crescent were rose-hued. He moved closer, mongrels in the lead, to the wigwam. When he peered inside, his shadow covered her head and chest. She was curled near the fire, thin, even smaller than he had imagined from the other side of the pond. She wore a leather blouse, laced under the sleeves and buttoned down the sides, wide cotton trousers, and leather leggings. He moved back to watch the dawn reach over her neck and cheeks. When her nose hitched, he retreated to his cabin. Lusterbow leaned on the window sash and brooded over his isolation. Then he marched down to the warm pond to bathe and wash his pungent clothes. Chicken Lips, the more curious of the two mongrels, hopped around inside the wigwam. He sniffed her hair, her feet, and then pushed his wet nose into her crotch. When she awakened, he sneezed and lost his balance, rolled over on the cedar boughs. Chicken Lips was mottled brown with three wide white paws. The right front paw had been severed in a beaver trap. White Lies was seated at the entrance. She was white with brown blotches and with narrow bands on her stout tail. Brown wisps shrouded her rear. She moaned, licked her sides, and snapped at a slow insect. The mongrels were more at home in the wigwam than on the rough boards in the cabin. Novena May and Lusterbow never lived in the same house. He remained in the cedar cabin he had built near the pond, and she lived in the wigwam where she delivered 10 children in 12 years. She was wild, generous, hushed. He was wild, bounteous, and hoarse. He screamed the names of his children over panic holes on the meadow. She marked the birth of her children on the hardwoods and taught them to read from leaves. She wrote words and names on leaves and scattered them on the hard snow. The children collected the leaves and told stories with random words, their voices on the rise. Lester Beau told wild stories, trickster and creation stories, and coached his children to scream into panic holes when the spirit moved them. The meadow was covered with wild blooms, nurtured with screams. Even the mongrels barked into holes and covered their sound with the earth. He was in motion when he told stories, never at rest. He worked with cedar, where he walked and talked, and waved his beaver stick between phrases. Lester Beau built small cedar cabins for each of his children, an enormous barn near the pond, and several other buildings for sheep, mongrels, and dead machines issued by the government. When he worked, he told stories about tribal tricksters who lived in compasses, clocks, watches, and church organs, where the best of them recast tunes, overturned time, and reversed magnetic directions in the manifest white world. The children learned apace to listen and then to imagine their connections to the earth. Each child earned a characteristic nickname and a comic temper to endure the ruthless brokers of a tragic civilization. The children learned that the old tribal tricksters turned rose window malevolence into comic beams and enlightened those who had lost their shadows on the concrete. Shadowbox Brown, the eldest son, and his two unmarried sisters remained with their parents, Lester and Novena May, at Petronia. The other seven children moved to small communities on the reservation. Two were reconciled in cities. Rain Brown and her brother Bones studied art and distinguished themselves as painters. He was a romantic and a tribal naturalist. She was a hard expressionist. Swarm, the eldest daughter, had vanished in a thunderstorm when she was 12. Two sons, the smallest and the most intrepid of the children, had died in a cloud of mustard gas over a narrow trench in the Great War. Shadowbox married Wink Martin, his cousin, who lived with her brother, Mouse Proof, at Bad Medicine Lake. Wink was silent, but never solemn. She was stout and her breath was bad. She covered her mouth with one hand to hide her rotten teeth. She winked when she listened and double-winked when she smiled. Wink counted and measured words with winks. She even winked to count her children, the cabins, the mongrels, the mallards on the pond, and the crows on the blue meadow. She winked over the panic holes, but never learned to scream. Lester Beau built a cedar cabin for each grandchild, two more for Mouse Proof Martin, who would not leave his sister, and one cabin for Griever de Hocus, the avian trickster from Bad Medicine Lake. When his children and grandchildren were grown and the cabins withered in silence, Lester Beau invited street tricksters, those with docked visions, mixed bloods from the cities, to live at Petronia. Three remained, learned his stories, and built their own cabins. The other mixed bloods screamed once into a panic hole and then braced their boredom at the last lecture, the nearest tavern, where they subscribed to new names and renewed identities. Mouse Proof Martin moved with his sister and established a new museum in the two cabins that the Baron of Petronia had built for him near the pond. Mouse Proof earned his nickname at a federal boarding school, where, on his hands and knees, he learned to read and write under an organ console. He waited, with one slack ear, at the narrow feet of his teacher when she played the organ in the classroom. There, on the bellows pedals, the two words of his nickname were pressed in metal. Mouse Proof turned onto the organ and looked up her dress, into her dark crotch, as she perched on the stool. Then, with one finger, he traced the deep letters in the two words on the base of the pedals. He carved these words on his battered wooden desk. He wounded trees with his written name, and he painted his name on the new water tower. Mouse Proof secured his name on the reservation, but he was better known as the trickster who collected lost and autographed shoes. His wild obsession with shoes started at the feet of his teacher, the smell of white flesh and polished leather, Later, when he found lost shoes at the roadside, he would remember his teacher and the unusual origin of his name. He owned thousands of lost shoes, each one cataloged, covered with a sock, and stored in his cabin archives. Once each season, he scheduled tours to various institutions and museums with a selection of his rare shoe collection. Mouse Proof and his wild shoe stories were popular on college campuses. He animated the lonesome shoes, moved them in uncommon pairs, uncovered their character and precise wear, and imagined in stories what had happened to the shoes that never got away, the shoes that were never lost. The children adored his stories about lost and lonesome shoes. Reaver de Hocus roamed with Mouse Proof Martin and told stories about meditation and broken wheels to college audiences. Griever was born without a name, the child of a caravan under the universal Hocus crown. His mother told him that she met his father at three places on the reservation. Once in the birch behind the parish house, twice on the old government road, and three times in the ice barn near the lake, and then, "The caravan and your father? Gone in less than a week." She never even learned his real name, never understood his peculiar language, but she remembers his tongue, his music, and she whistles his wild tunes at night. Most of all, she remembers what he said about griever time. "Griever time meditation," he told her in the dark, "cures common colds, headaches, heartaches, tired feet, and humdrum blood." The caravan sold plastic icons with grievous poses, miniature grails, Veronicas, and instruction manuals entitled, "How to be sad and downcast and still live in better health than people who pretend to be so happy." She owes her old age to griever time meditation three nights a week. Griever owes his name and humor to her compulsive lamentations, but not much more. Mouse Proof and Griever de Hocus met under the organ console and were close friends at boarding school. Wink Brown covered her mouth with both hands, counted nine children, her husband, brother, and stopped on 11 winks. "No more," she whispered, "no more bad breath," and she uncovered an enormous cast of ceramic teeth. Mormons provided the teeth, an inducement to their religion. Wink smiled at the missionaries twice a week for 3 months, an estimate of the value, and then she returned to the old mission and the mean deacon with the whiny breath. Instead of winking, she clicked her teeth. Wink was so pleased with her smile that she traveled with her brother, Mouse Proof, and his shoe collection to several museum shows. Shadowbox counted cabins and names marked on the trees near the pond. "China," he shouted, "firstborn daughter, Tune, eldest son, Tulip, the detective, Garlic, the farmer, Ginseng, the root hustler, Eternal flame, once a nun, Father, mother, once a priest, Mime, who imitated her mother, and Sly Boots, the avian dreamer and microlight radical." China was born when the clover and rue anemone were in bloom on the meadow. Shadowbox roared with the scarlet hunters that morning. The mongrels circled the cabin and barked at their loose shadows. Lusterbow shouted in a panic hole to celebrate the birth of his first grandchild. Chickenlips waited at the bedside and whined over the child. He mocked her babble, and then he licked her little pink feet. He pushed his smooth tongue between her moist toes. The more she moved her toes, the more he licked. White Lies and Chicken Lips, namesake mongrels, inherited their names. Seven mongrels barked into panic holes on the meadow, withered and died, but their names were resurrected in each generation. Petronia children remembered the same mongrel names in their tribal stories. China Brown teased Chicken Lips when she was older. She would spread her toes to catch his smooth tongue. Later, she pretended that her feet were bound, golden lotuses under blue bandanas, and the mongrels were her eunuchs. Blusterbow claimed that he heard the echo of her name when he shouted into a panic hole, down to the other side of the earth, to the other world. China studied literature, the first child from the baronage to graduate from college, and she traveled around the world as a magazine writer. Chicken Lips came to mind whenever she was lonesome or insecure. She would remember the reservation and that warm mongrel tongue between her toes. Now, once or twice a week, she draws silk ribbons between her toes, an unusual meditation, and the certain origin of her nickname. And that was The Baron of Petronia by Gerald Weisner. Now we shall read Snatched Away by Mary Tallmountain. Near 4 Mile Summer Camp, the Indians were nudging their fish wheel into calmer water. The Yukon was in a fierce, frowning mood. It tossed spray hissing skyward, hurled it back down like heavy rain into the weltering currents. Where stubborn little creeks shouldered out insistently, the river surged to attack, writhing up in silt-brown rapids. Accustomed to its tempers, the men kept tending the wheel, which alternately plunged two carved spruce arms into the current to rotate with the tide. An oblong wire basket at the end of the arm scooped up fish. On the next rotation, as the arm tipped, the fish slithered into a box nailed to the raft deck of the fish wheel. The arm loomed up again like a windmill blade, fell back, and turned with the force of the tides. The ascent of dog salmon heralded the coming of autumn. Fish flowed in a stream of silvery rose. Quick dark silhouettes against the greens of alder and cottonwood, the Indians were part of sky, river, earth itself. They wove dories through tumbling water, pulled schools of darting salmon, strode like lumberjacks. Born rivermen, Clem thought, with respect. Still, the river was a tough customer. In the 7 years he'd been there, 10 men and boys had drowned between Nulato and Kalteg. Andy was the latest, and him only 22. The day in 1916 when Clem unloaded his gear at Nulato Garrison, he'd met 15-year-old Andy on the riverbank, where the army had barged the new soldiers upriver. A crooked tooth leaning into his wide white grin, the lad had offered to help Clem with his violin and banjo cases. Even then, Andy was the best there was. Hunter, fisherman, trapper. Nobody could beat him. Only the river could have beaten Andy. Clem's boat chugged into the immense, misted expanses. He wondered how Andy had felt, knowing himself caught, fighting. Did he see sky and trees flashing past? How long had he struggled, tumbled over and over in the fast rips out there, where nothing existed to snag a man and hold him solid so he could keep his head above the deadly tides? Andy had never been found, though 2 months had passed. A cry had been heard on shore, but when the men got out and rowed toward the sound, only the voice of the river met them. Andy's empty canoe had floated in a gentle rift behind an island of silt, growing in midstream. Their friendship had stretched through the years. Clem had eaten with Andy's large family, gone with the men on hunting trips when they had leave from duty. He had thought the natives liked him as well as any Gisak, the word they had for white men. Clem thought of the afternoon he had spent talking on the riverbank with Andy and Little Jim. He thought Little Jim was related too, some way. Cousins, maybe? He couldn't find out how these people were hooked up together. Something about the families, how their forebearers were related, and the kinship among the whole Athabascan people. Well, it was as dim and as old as time. The next section is in italics, which means it's a flashback. Clem glanced over at Andy now and then. He'd already discovered that these natives didn't like to be stared at. He tried to keep them from catching him. And he didn't seem to notice. In the tall grass, he lounged on his side, wearing a white man's wool shirt and store-bought overalls, chewing a grass stem, fur cap low over his eyes. He looked just like his father, Big Mike, the stubby Russian, the way Mike must have looked when he was 15 and a lot skinnier. Andy's eyes were fixed on the river. About 50 feet out, a small bundle came rolling down fast, something tied tight in a gunny sack. "Hey, what's that?" Clem asked. "Yeah," little Jim muttered. "It's a baby," Andy said, following it with his gaze as it tossed and turned round and round downriver. "What the hell?" Clem thought he'd heard wrong. "Baby, throw it away." Andy chewed fast, wagging the grass back and forth. "When baby comes out, maybe he got bum leg, maybe no leg, or he come out wrong, head mashed. Women say he's no good. Tie him up. Dump him over the river bank." He appeared to draw in his breath, but Clem couldn't fathom any change in his expression. "They used to do it in the old time," Andy said. "Things were worse then. They quit doing it, but sometimes women still throw them if they're too bad." Andy looked out over the river, barely rippling, shining, innocent. A flock of snow geese, in formation passing south, announced their departure in ancient ceremonial voice. Little Jim said, "Lots of babies die in old time. They get Gissack disease. That mean white man's sickness. We got a doctor now, but when grandfather was living it was real bad. The people name him Old Russian." Clem asked, "How did Old Russian get here on the river?" Andy said, "Grandfather, well, he's really my grandfather's papa, you know. He come up river with three Russians. We call them Gissack too, like all white men. They talk all the time. Maybe we call them that name because they talk about Cossack. You go round, get to be called Gissack." Both men chuckled as if it was an old joke. Andy went on, "But then came other Russians. Buy furs from our people in our old hunting mountains, we call Caillou. Those ones build big Russian kashim to live in, and Trader's Post store, on the river south of where New Lotto sits now." He pointed the grass stem south. "Down there. That town is all gone now. Koyokuk warrior start war, burn down kashim, everybody die inside." Silence followed while the men considered the ancient violence. "After they die, sickness come," little Jim said. "First it's smallpox. Old people say Gissack bring it. Who knows where it come from? No way to write it down. That's a long time ago. Those people only talk, not read. Now we have this new sickness, this consumption, TB. "That pretty bad?" Clem asked. Little Jim frowned. "Yeah, no way to cure that when it get a hold. If they could go outside, there's hospitals for it. But who could go outside? Cost too much dinga." He rubbed his thumb against his finger in the universal sign for money. Andy swept his arms wide. "Many other ways to die, though," he said, crossing his legs, settling deeper into the grass. "Sometimes a house catch fire. We fight it with river water. Maybe people burn up anyway. Short life for some of us. That's why our people get married so young," he laughed. Little Jim stared down river. "Lots of people drown. The current play tricks. Hide. Next thing, it's got you. Pretty near got me couple times," he grinned. "We don't swim. Nobody swims." "Jesus," Clem said. Now we're back to the present. With a heave of brown water, the river slammed a log into the bow of the boat, jolting Clem out of his flashes of reverie. Whew, no damage done. 7 years ago, he would have been alert to the river's tricks at a safe enough distance to get out of the way, he thought, steering away from the middle. The river hadn't been too tough for him back then. He was already a rugged fella, fresh from the cavalry duty on the Mexican border, lean as a malamute, hair a sun-bleached shock against perennially brown skin. His intent, sea-colored eyes incessantly changed with the lights, focusing as if to X-ray everything he saw. His air was alert and confident. 7 years on the Yukon had converted him into a critter, tough as walrus hide. It was his first taste of the wilderness, raising dogs, training them for sled work and distance travel, running search-rescue missions by dog team in winter, by motorboat in summer. All around him stretched this stark and beautiful land. He tried to write his feelings in notes of music on scraps like the secret fragments of a poet, but they escaped him. Away in the corner of his mind, an old piano tinkled playing Mary Jo's favorites, Yum Yum Waltz and Pity Sing Polka. The notes echoed tinnily in his head. At Ruby, a red-hot boomtown, he'd been playing the tunes steadily for the past 3 days and nights. The miners and the horrors had hollered for dance music. He'd rounded up young Charlie Wilson, a native banjo picker, and they went up by motorboat. Those wild, rough folks had insisted on hijinks and kept Clem and Charlie playing day and night. Wouldn't let them rest. Threw gold and dollar bills to them. Yelled for them to keep going. Offered bad bootleg, he and Charlie waved away. The boys worked themselves so dizzy that Charlie had stayed on with kinfolks for a visit. Clem was dog-tired. He was homesick. He'd been away from Mary Jo too long already. His biceps were numb from the kick of the tiller against him. That fast-leaping current was deadly. He kept veering into it. 20- and 30-foot trees tumbled up like matchsticks, roots clawing toward the sky. He swung over, pivoted the boat into still water. Even after he dropped anchor, the river kept grabbing, trying to yank him back. He knuckled his eyes. When his vision cleared, he saw tall green reeds in a slough 60 yards off. Suddenly, a clump of ducks rose, bunched, started climbing. Shots cracked. Clem flattened fast. 4 birds dropped. The flock fluttered south out of gun sight. Who the hell is it? I didn't see a boat, he thought. Nothing moved. Then Floyd Tommy pried out of the reeds, holding a bunch of mallards. He ambled over. Got a couple. He held up the birds. I come down here early, before the sun. Sometimes a few ducks stop here. Nice fat mallard, Clem said. Not so bad. Been feeding all summer. Floyd's gangling young body was wet to the waist. Scared them up, I guess, Clem said, climbing out of the boat, his red rubber packs plopping in the water. Ice tingled clear through the heavy rubber, the thick wool socks, on up the long johns. Feeding off the bottom, Floyd said, and grabbed a duck by its ringed neck, and a second. He dropped them on the grass. Grub for the pot, anyways. That's swell. Thanks. Clem admired the birds, the green shine of their feathers. Nothing extra, Floyd said. Clem fished out a tin of King Albert. Take a smoke, he offered. Floyd pocketed the tobacco. He coughed deeply and spit. The spit hung on a weed, a strand of pink swaying in the wind. He walked away, and Clem saw his sharp shoulder blades, thin butt. Consumption, he thought. Kids shouldn't smoke. Sorry I gave him tobacco. Clem crawled up the bank, lay flat under a tree. Fine there, let his whole body go quiet. He thought, let the stillness float into and around him while he stared at the scrambled, pale blue sky. Kid's cough made him think of Mary Jo. Another flashback. Right after Clem had come to New Lotto, he'd struck up an acquaintance with Cap Jagger, the trader. They played fiddle and guitar for dances, with Freddie Kriska jingling and clinking away on his banjo. They practiced in Cap's store. One evening, Clem was outside to take a breath. Mary Jo was sitting on the porch step. He couldn't resist. He laid his hand on her gleaming, waist-long hair, bound with a bright purple band. "What a beautiful girl," he said. Once he'd seen her running through the village, hair flying, had seen that even in shapeless trousers and faded cotton shirt, she was lovely. She got up. Her smile seemed to glow in the dusk as she floated closer in a movement sensuous as a cat's. They faced each other. He smelled wind and furs, and something elusive, like sweet grass. They stood motionless, barely breathing. Then she broke the hush. "I'm about as tall as you, Clem Stone. You're my brother's friend. You know Andy. I come and listen to you play music, but I always go away. This time, I risk it." "There's no risk, girl. I'm not dangerous," he muttered. The very air felt electric with the closeness of her. "Oh, yes, you are," she said. She pulled out a large white handkerchief, coughed lightly into it. A tingling, was it a foreshadowing of an unknowable sorrow, shivered along his nerves. Somehow, he sensed, it broke an impasse. She told him she'd just turned 21. She lived with her father, her brother Andy, and a younger brother, Stephen. Her mother, Matmia, two sisters, and a third brother had died of TB. Times were bad for the people. She did laundry for soldiers at the station. They wore Alaska Warmies, a special army issue of long johns. The damned brown army soap shrank them midget-sized. Mary Jo had a special way to wash them. It kept her busy, along with looking after her menfolk, getting in a little fishing, tending a few traps. Just surviving. She had skills he'd never known existed. The traps and snares she so carefully laid, empty when the animals couldn't come out to tackle the howling cold. Wolves running hungry, moose, caribou, galloping broomstick thin before the wolves. And in the village, the hungry children. Back to the present. Affection for her family was part of the whole business of hunger, he thought. It hadn't been like that with his folks, back in California. Hardly a time he could remember when Pa, or even Ma, showed their love for him and Brother Jas, except when they were tykes, and then it was like he dreamed it. Becky, his mother, was always wrapped in thought, eyes far away, lips moving. How badly he wanted to get into her head. She kept her thoughts wrapped up inside, the way she wrapped her outside, in dark dresses and big white aprons with tails that tied round and round and hid her tiny waist. He hoped she was happy at last. She'd finally married Balch Jobson, the hired man, after she divorced Pa. Right away, Pa married that woman from Hoptown. Pure orneriness. Pa had that terrible temper. Suspicioned Balch and Becky so hard he finally had to leave her. Clem frowned. He'd never figured out why as a kid he'd been jealous over Becky and Balch too. Vaguely, he knew he'd inherited a trait of jealousy. He supposed he'd got it from Pa. When he thought of Mary Jo and Taria, he got too mad to talk. She'd married that old man when she was 14, had a son the next year. Not long ago, Taria had gone down to live in Caltag and had taken their son with him. Why'd she let that boy go, and him only 5? When Clem tried to talk to her about it, she always got him off the track with a funny remark or with dinner on the table or lovemaking. Anything to derail him. Mary Jo was jealous, too, in her secret way. There was the day he'd been talking to young Tala, and Mary Jo came along the boardwalk, stalked right up to them, and walloped him a good one on the jaw. She never mentioned it afterwards, but it kind of lay there between them. Mary Jo had wanted one of those little medicine sacks made of caribou hide to hang on her belt. He'd asked Tala to make one, and he'd been telling her how the initials ought to be. Mary Jo thought he was sparking the girl. Well, jealousy or no, Clem and Mary Jo had given Lidwin and Michael enough love to last a lifetime. His mind magnetized to a worry that had been shoved back these few hectic days. He and Mary Jo were about to lose their kids. She'd found out from Doc Merrick that she had consumption, and he had offered to adopt them. Mary Jo had got so worked up over that, he realized she'd forgotten Clem's last hitch was about up. Strange, but no use worrying yet. He'd just have to let things take their course. Hell, like he always figured, it would come out in the wash. A jay screamed from a lodgepole pine. Clem stood, whirled his arms, kneaded his shoulders, took a fast run along the beach and back. New energy shuttled through his blood. Kicking the boat off, he noticed his tiller arm had eased up. He'd make it. He had a damn good bulge of strength in those biceps, but his calculation had misfired again. As usual, he had underrated the river. The damn thing yanked him every which way. Time blurred. No Oi, as the natives called the sun, was well up in the sky. Its light dazzled him, and he centered in again on the tiller. God, that spirit of energy hadn't lasted. At last, through his daze, he saw Pete Slough alongside. Soft, gray-blue wings of a pair of teal flapped and rose. His eyes swarmed with blurs as he turned from the river glare, staggering stiffly up the bank. Willie Pitka was netting a whitefish in the ruffled waters of the Slough. He hauled in 3 fish, 10 to 14 inches long, threw them into a washtub. Willie looked as if he had always been there. He was strong, fierce-looking, like most of the Tenai's Athabascans. Good hunter, 10 kids working every day, well-fed. "Fishing pretty good today," Willie said, pointing to the nearly filled tub. Clem pummeled his cramped, knotted arm. "Good big fish," he said. "You come down from Ruby, yeah?" Willie eased the hand-woven net into the water. It flowed between his chunky fingers, barely rippling into the water. "Been playing for a dance up there," Clem said, walking back and forth, the numbness inching out of his knees. "River rising pretty fast. Plenty wood coming down," Willie said. "Yeah, it was real bad a few miles up. Got tired of fighting it and stopped up yonder, below Tommy's camp. Floyd was getting a few mallard." Willie nodded. "There's a few places up there. Duck come every year about this time. Floyd knows them pretty good." "Oh yeah, you gotta watch that river." "Need eyes in the back of your head. Easier in winter when she's frozen over," Clem said. "You still got your lead dog, Beauty?" Willie asked. "You bet. She's my brood mother, pure Malamute. I've got the best team on the river. Hey, you know Minuska built me a dog sled all spruce? Not a nail, bound with walrus hide. Laid it around the joints wet, and it dried like iron." "How much you pay him?"
Couple of sawbucks."
"Worth it. You take care of your team there at the station?"
"Yeah, I've got a pot outside to boil their fish.
I've got 3 males, 2 females, 1 out of Beauty. Bought my breeder, Moose, from old man Patsy. Set me back 50, but he's worth every cent. Saved my bacon more than once on the trail. He knows everything, even in the worst storms." Willie chuckled. "Like you got money in the bank. Uncle Sam has to pay every time you use that team for army business, yeah?"
paid for itself 100 times over. Clem pulled a package of salmon strip and biscuit. The rich smoke made his taste buds water. He lay back and eased his shoulder muscles into the sun-warm padding of dry reeds. He looked up at the willows. They leaned nearly horizontal over the water. Fallen trees had been bleached to ivory skeletons and lay crushed and scattered. Small waves slapped the sides of Willie's dory. The watery sounds soothed Clem to sleep.
"You got it made better'n 3/4 downriver to home now."
The voice was just loud enough. Yes, Willie figured I'd snooze too long. Clem thought, time to get on. The voice continued.
"You going to New Lotto?"
Willie's dense eyebrows almost grazed his straight, soot-colored lashes. "That's where I'm heading. 2, maybe 3 hours.
"Yeah, 3 hours do it, I guess," Willie said, hauling net.
He tossed another pair of whitefish into the tub, piled the net with great care into the dory. His teeth gleamed with good humor. "Your camp downriver a ways?" Clem asked. He stretched and yawned. He thought, "I'm rested now. Maybe I can make it before dark."
"Yeah, we used the same old camp. Had that camp many years. Good run on kings this summer. Usually I come up here, get whitefish, let my boys handle the wheel."
Clem looked south. Away, faint in the clear air, the purple crest of the Caillou Range rested on the horizon. "Willie," he pointed, "you think there's a woodsman in Caillou?" Willie's face crinkled around the grin in tiny rolls of brown, velvety skin.
"Oh, sure. Lots of woodsmen over there."
"You ever see one?" Clem wasn't sure Willie was on the level, probably joshing him.
"Yup, mad like bear, bad like bear. Steal babies."
Willie's crinkles deepened and formed fans. They laughed. "So long, Willie."
"See ya."
Clem stepped into his boat and pulled the starter cord. The engine barked, and on the next yank, snapped to life. Almost at once, the boat kept trying to get out of his hands and pull out into the heavy rip. He needed all his wits just keeping her steady outside the churning middle river. A red horde of dog salmon thrashed upriver. They leaped against the edges of the riptide, fell back. He steered away, the tiller held hard against his body. "It's a stampede out there," he thought, looking over his shoulder at the line of furious red dog salmon action. "There's something besides fish alive out in that river." He had a sudden sense of repeated time, of some old and half-forgotten grief. A final flashback. He was carrying Ladwin along a village path, and her frosty breaths puffed out on the windless air. Mary Jo's boots padded behind him as his heavy steps angrily crunched the snow. He held a swinging lantern. Its light bobbed in yellow winkings. His mind babbled. "We will go on through the night snow, and we will never come back. We will go to the hills, Mary Jo. They will never part us." She caught up with him. There was no sound as Mary Jo looked into the baby's face. The moon reflected roundly silver into her pupils. Snow drifted down out of the spruces. The silence was broken by a sighing sound, descending from an immense distance. His anger left him. Only weariness remained. He turned with Mary Jo and they went back. Inside the cabin, he laid the baby in bed and kissed the corner of her sleeping mouth. At his shoulder, Mary Jo said, "You can't have her. She must go somewhere else." His breath was heavy. He heard the muffled beating of his heart. Her face was deep in the shadows. "Clem, I have a new baby in here." She laid his hand on her belly, and they rested on the lynx fur blankets. His mind played a small, wandering melody. They drifted to sleep. And back to the present. He did not know whether it was a dream or a strange, obscure knowledge. Now it had come again to him in the fury of the river. The somber weariness of his body, he saw their faces in the aimless, enclosing mists of the Yukon, and he knew it would be so for all of his life. He looked at his hands, rigidly white on the tiller. Needles of ice prodded them. The beaver-lined moosehide mittens he had forgotten to bring flashed into his mind. Mary Jo had sewn and beaded them. Her face came toward him, the high flush of her flaring cheekbones, the gentle hollows beneath, the eyes he could never describe, the children, their laughter flashing white. Three faces, together, wavering in the thin and growing mist. Indian, Indianness. The words floated through his thoughts. He jerked his head, trying to flick away the daze. He shouted into the wind, "What difference now, how much the blood is mixed? Our kids are as much Irish or Russian or Scotch as Indian. What difference now?" His words were snatched away by the wind. And that was Snatched Away by Mary Tall Mountain. Thank you for joining us again for Western Short Stories as we've been reading from Talking Leaves, Contemporary Native American Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowpoke went riding out one dark and winded day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he drove. Aye, yippee-i-ho.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device as well.